Hello, everyone, and welcome to Food Safety Matters, the podcast for food safety professionals. I'm Stacey Hutchison, publisher of Food Safety Magazine, and I'm here with my co-host, Barbara Van Renterham, editorial director of the magazine.
Ta-da!
Well, that's quite a start.
Well,
I don't even
morning.
Know. I've got nothing after
that. No, it
that.
Isn't morning. It's not morning. It's morning for you. I'll say good morning to you.
Well, that's debatable, but given how long I've been awake, but that's another story. That's another topic. Anyway, good to be with you here. So for today's episode, you're going to hear Barbara's interview with Dr. Scott Brooks, Senior Vice President of Food Safety and Quality Assurance for Tyson Foods. Scott was also an early guest on the Food Safety Matters podcast. He was our guest on episode 7. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes. That is indeed another great episode. So without exception, and I mean that genuinely, without exception, we are grateful to all of our guests who take time to come on the podcast and are willing to freely share their experience with our audience. But Scott Brooks gets a special mention from us. Tyson has been one of the companies at the forefront of the COVID crisis this year. And as we are all too painfully aware, this is an ongoing and an even worsening crisis. So a very special thanks to Scott for being generous with his time and experience at this critical time. Needless to say, you will want to stay tuned for that interview after the news. And speaking of news, you know, I always want to keep our listeners in the loop on Food Safety Matters podcast news. And now that I think of it, what this is actually more like Food Safety Matters podcast trivia, or maybe it's an audio thank you note. But so the other day, I was preparing a report on the podcast for our new bosses at BMP Media. I was gathering all kinds of impressive facts and figures, most of which have to do with what an amazing audience of worldwide followers we have. Yes, dear listeners, take a bow. You are always center stage in our hearts, minds, and reports. Anyway, so I looked at the total number of episodes that we've produced, and it was a very round and a very impressive 100 episodes. This includes regular and bonus episodes, but wow, this is a major accomplishment.
Are you sure you aren't missing a zero there? It really seems like more. That is impressive, though.
It is impressive. Now, Barbara, when you say that, it makes it sound like you haven't enjoyed, you know, this experience.
No. So on the contrary, you clearly haven't listened to the little talks that I've given at various places when I say how much fun it has been.
Yes, it is. So. It is a lot of fun. And that was actually part of the report too. I said how much fun we have doing it. I don't know that that was that impressive to them, but that part is very impressive to us and hopefully to you, dear listeners. So anyway, I just want to say thank you. We really couldn't have done it. We couldn't keep doing it without you. We appreciate your support. We appreciate your enthusiasm. And so insert confetti screen emoji here, which is one of my favorites, you know, that full screen, like poof, confetti everywhere.
I hit
the mic for emphasis.
It's like when you win solitaire and you get the little, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. So
there you
that's
go.
What's
not
I'm
that I play solitaire
everybody.
At work.
No,
not
never.
That I, play solitaire.
I don't play
no.
any games on my phone ever. No, no, none of that.
No.
Mm-mm. All right. We really do have some real live food safety news, though. So here we go. So, here we go. Back in September, FDA released a proposed rule to establish additional traceability record-keeping requirements for certain foods. The food traceability proposed rule is a key component of FDA's new era of smarter food safety blueprint and would implement Section 204D of the Food Safety Modernization Act. To assist stakeholders in understanding this proposed rule, FDA is making a number of additional resources available. The first, provides access to the risk ranking model that was used to score commodity hazard pairs used to determine which foods were included on the food traceability list. There's a pre-recorded webinar featuring FDA's Deputy Commissioner for Food Policy and Response, Frank Yannis, always referred in this podcast to as just Frank, and Angela Fields, a traceability subject matter expert. In the webinar, they discuss the benefits of the proposed rule, who would be subject to the rule, key requirements, exemptions, and more. There's also a who is subject to the rule flowchart and key terms glossary. So, which just reminds me of like one of the best headlines of all time. So a tip of the hat to our colleague Coral Beach over at Food Safety News, who penned the headline back in September, FDA floats rule for tracing records on some foods from some sources some of the time. And I guess it's not long from there that you get to the flowchart, right?
There you go.
Right.
Now, from so what I understand.
Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead. You can
Well, there's also a series of virtual public meetings, the second of which will be held on December 2nd. The first one already happened. So the second one is going to be on December 2nd. So we'll put a link to this story, and you'll find links to all of these resources, including the flowchart.
I think the first one is either today or tomorrow, but
yeah,
it's not going to be.
By the time people hear this, it will be next week. So
right.
This was like you're time traveling now, Barbara.
Well, can I go back? That would be very helpful.
We'll try that next time. Yeah.
So from what I understand, it's really good that they have these resources available because I don't think they're planning any training like they have for a lot of the FSMA regulations. So no training yet. But if something changes, we'll be sure to let everybody know. But
no training, lots of resources.
Right. And it sounds like on lots of different platforms. So depending on how you learn best, they probably have something just for you.
There you go. Cool. All right. And next up, Barbara's headline for this in our news section was, here we go again. E. coli found in romaine. So federal officials
really
are
proud of that, by the way.
I know you were. So I had to mention it. So don't want to give Coral all the credit here. So federal officials are investigating an outbreak of E. coli 0157H7 infections. Although CDC says the cause is unknown, it also says recalled romaine lettuce has tested positive for the outbreak strain of the pathogen. Earlier this month, California-based Tanimura and Antle recalled whole romaine heads from 20 states. The recall came after the Michigan Department of Agriculture found E. coli in the company's romaine as part of its routine sampling program. Both CDC and FDA are investigating the outbreak. FDA has reported that a cause has not been determined. Quote, the strain of E. coli found in the Michigan sample is a third distinct strain, not genetically related to the strains causing two distinct multi-state outbreaks of Shigatoxin producing E. coli 0157H7. That's confusing me, Barbara, but that's a lot of talk of a lot of different strains that doesn't add up to really them saying much of anything, but I shall continue.
Okay.
All right. CDC announced on October 28th that at this time, a specific food has not been linked to either of those outbreaks. Thankfully, no deaths have been reported, but illnesses span California, Illinois, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Virginia.
So I talked to one of our favorite produce gurus, Will Daniels, about all of these messages coming from CDC and FDA. So this is actually the third outbreak of 0157H7. In none of them have CDC or FDA pointed to a particular food source. However, and this is what I talked to Will about, because I said, in one of the first ones, FDA said it was similar to the outbreak strain from Romaine in 2018. And the second one was similar to the outbreak strain in Romaine from 2019. CDC, for those first two, said they were identical to those outbreak strains. So I asked him, you know, am I making more out of this than I really should? Is it just a matter of semantics? We're getting mixed messages, very confusing from these agencies. And he suggested that it might be how the scientists at these agencies refer to the whole genome sequencing results. So, and then he started talking about SNPs and all kinds of molecular biology. And
is that part of the episode then? Is that going to be part of the, was that an aside or is that going to be part of the episode?
No, it's going to be, part of the episode.
Yes.
I don't know if I necessarily agree with that. I think there should be some uniform messaging with these outbreaks. I personally think all three are related to romaine. I think the preponderance of evidence really leads in that direction. However, I'm willing to admit, and I told Will, you know, I could be wrong, but my gut says it's romaine all over again. So there you have it.
There it is. Well, I guess I'll just stick with thankfully no one has died. So I'm sorry these people are sick, but thankfully. And then you have to also wonder, too, now with hospitals starting to explode again, what's going to, you know, the effects on on food safety and traceability when it comes to outbreaks as we move into another sort of phase of, you know, oh, my God.
But we did have a romaine outbreak around Thanksgiving. So this is, you know, that time of year.
Yeah. Oh, great. Now we've got romaine. Now we've got E. coli season.
You thought flu season was all you had to worry about. Now we have romaine season.
I don't know. 2020, I can tell you, just like, dude, whatever. All right.
It's been something.
It's been something. And for our next story, in response to FDA issuing a voluntary guidance on allergen labeling for sesame in ingredient lists, FAIR, which is the Food Allergy Research and Education Foundation, the world's leading NGO engaged in food allergy advocacy and the largest private funder of food allergy research, sent a letter to the agency explaining that this does not go far enough. FAIR's executive officer, Lisa Gable, noted, quote, "On behalf of the 32 million Americans who suffer from life-threatening food allergies and the 1.5 million Americans allergic to sesame, FAIR is disappointed in the FDA's proposed guidance to industry regarding the voluntary disclosure of sesame as an allergen that was issued on November 10th. While the guidance is a step in the right direction, sesame needs to be recognized as the 9th top allergen, and it must be labeled," end quote. They cited increased prevalence of sesame allergy, stories of accidental ingestion of sesame that led to anaphylaxis and death, and the fact that sesame is used in hundreds of foods from bread to ice cream. Okay, who knew? Which I guess is the point. FAIR reminds FDA that allergic consumers depend on ingredient labels to make healthy and safe purchasing decisions, and says that the agency should revise its guidance to industry and mandate that sesame be labeled. Then, mere days later, the U.S. House of Representatives unanimously passed the FASTER Act, which was introduced in 2019 by Representative Doris Matsui of California, the Food Allergy Safety Treatment Education Act, aka FASTER Act, declares sesame among the top 9 allergens as recognized by FDA, making labeling mandatory and expanding research to find new treatments. That must have been some letter.
Well, except that FAIR introduced this recently, but that this particular act was introduced in 2019. So,
and there was other stuff. The first letter that they sent was actually in relationship to the 2018 introduction. I'm losing my facts here, but hold on. Well, that's the 2019, but there was something from 2018 too. And I believe that was about the first part. And then this was reintroduced by, so there's been a lot of activity on allergens here, but that was kind of bam, bam. You know, we were covering the one like, okay, this is news. And then all of a sudden whiplash, you know, but the bill is being sent to the Senate for consideration, where it has five sponsors. There's also a Senate version of the bill, and FAIR will seek to introduce both bills during the first 100 days of the 117th session of Congress.
Yay!
So we'll see.
I have a little science fact for curious people out there. I knew that sesame was declared an allergen in a lot of other countries. So I got I went to the University of Nebraska's FARP site, which is the Food Allergy Research and Resource Program.
Episode 4, Steve Taylor.
I was just going to say Steve's group. So besides Canada, most of Europe, most of the EU, Australia, and what they label as the GSO. I thought, what is that? But that is Gulf, essentially Persian Gulf states. So Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Kuwait, Bahrain, Oman, Qatar, and Yemen. And Iceland. How about that? And okay. there are a couple other countries that I missed.
That's not a Gulf state. Okay. So Gulf states Iceland.
I said and Yemen. I put the and in there. So that was at the end of the group. Okay. And Iceland was just kind of hanging out there in the Atlantic. But anyway, they have great maps. We'll put a link in the show notes to this because it's kind of cool to poke around. And you can look at a bunch of different allergens and who has regulations about it. So cool. That's very good information, but it's fun to play around. And so
it begs the question in a multinational food world, right? I mean, wouldn't labeling then, you would kind of label for the common denominators there, wouldn't you? Or do you, I guess not. There's probably a lot of foods that have specific labeling for different.
Yeah. Labeling is unique to all the different countries and their foods, which posed a problem in the pandemic of crossing country lines, you know, to help out your neighbor. So the labeling was an issue there. So,
yeah. Well, so we're going to have great links to all of that and the fun map from Barbara's
FARP.
So be sure. Yeah. From FARP. So, okay, cool. All right, for more background on all of today's news and the links to all the resources that we've mentioned, visit our podcast page and click on the show notes for episode 84. And don't forget, follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. Just search for Food Safety Magazine. And now it's time for Barbara's discussion with Dr. Scott Brooks, Senior Vice President of Food Safety and Quality Assurance for Tyson Foods. Previously, Scott held similar food safety, quality, and regulatory executive positions at Kraft Heinz, PepsiCo, and Yum Brands after serving as a public health officer in the Air Force. His doctorate is in veterinary medicine with master's degrees in both food microbiology and preventative veterinary medicine. He served on the National Advisory Committee on Microbiology Criteria for Foods and is a past president of the American College of Veterinary Preventative Medicine.
I wanted to second your thanks to Scott. I thought that I might have to talk him into talking about COVID and because of all the press that Tyson had received. But it was his suggestion to really tackle this topic in the podcast. But I thought it was important to get the perspective of a food safety professional with a meat processor, just because of all the media coverage. And there's always another side to the story from what gets reported in the media. So we wanted to give Scott and Tyson a chance to tell their side of things. So,
And I'm sure he mentions it specifically in your interview, but he also sent over a promoting workplace safety in the era of COVID-19, keeping employees, their families, and communities healthy and safe. It's a document that he wanted to be sure that we share with the audience. So, yeah, I mean, he talks a lot about going back. Go ahead.
No, I just wanted to say that they've really done a lot of great work. And he discusses all the challenges that they had. And certainly Tyson's a large company. They have deep pockets. And so they were able to fly halfway around the world to get PPE for their employees. So,
wow. Yeah.
It was great.
Well, yeah. And he talks a lot about the relationships between the communities and the plants, which is something that we've kind of explored. We kind of poked out here and there. I mean, it's a lot to expect that these companies are going to be able to control something that's running rampant in communities. So anyway, it's a very, very, very interesting interview. And here it is now.
Well, hi, Scott. It's great to have you back on the podcast.
Well, thanks, Barbara. It's good to be back again with you.
You know, so much has happened since we last spoke, the least of which this crazy pandemic, which is especially of interest as we talk today, since you are now at Tyson Foods. So let's get started. So, geez, Senior Vice President of Food Safety and Quality Assurance at Tyson, how is it that now you find yourself in charge of food safety at over 100 facilities in the U.S.? How does that work for you? Do you have managers at all of the plants, or do they all report to you somehow? What's that been like?
Yeah, we have a very centralized structure at Tyson. And actually, as I joined back in December of last year, pre-COVID, by the way, that was one of the things that when I joined, we brought together centrally. So we have a number of different segments within our company. We have the fresh meats group. We have the fresh poultry. We have prepared foods. We have international. We even have a McDonald's segment within our company. They're obviously a very important customer to us. But the way we have it structured is from the plant level on up through to me, we have a direct connection with all of our food safety and quality team members across the company. And I think that's really good to make sure that we have so-called separation of church and state, that we have some really good people, but this just makes sure that everybody's honest and there's a clear line of communication. If there are problems, we have a clear route to me to make sure that that's addressed. And then, of course, I have a route up to the CEO as needed to do that. But, you know, it rarely ever goes to that point because of the structure itself lends itself to a really good system for food safety and quality.
Mm-hmm. We know the meat industry in North America has had its share of challenges earlier this year, notably the high numbers of employees testing positive for coronavirus. What do you think the contributing factors were for such high numbers at the beginning?
Well, you know, the whole thing with COVID really came up quickly. Again, I said I started in December, and then I think the first cases were reported, at least at the time, out of China, right at the very end of December. And then, you know, for the good month of January, it was still more of a Wuhan, China kind of thing, maybe a little bit outside of that. And then, wow, before you knew it, it hit in the U.S. There were some reported cases, but then there was still a lot of, well, it's isolated. We can keep it ring-fenced in certain areas of the country. As you know, Barbara, my background is in veterinary medicine and epidemiology, public health, and food science. And so I kind of was thinking, you know, this is going to be a pretty big one. I'd still had a hope that I'd been through the experience, as many of your listeners have, with H1N1 influenza back in 2009. And I had a hope that it would peak and then the controls would allow it to essentially kind of move away. Same thing maybe that would happen with SARS, the original SARS and MERS and Ebola and other kinds of things.
Sure.
But you know, it really did come up quickly and it kept coming up. And I think that, you know, what we saw was that the transmission, as we saw cases increase across the country in various regions, and we were watching what was going on in the country, you know, really when we had cases in our team members in our establishments, it was quite reflective of what was going on in the communities. So, you know, our team members spend about a third of their day approximately in our plants, but about two thirds of the day outside our facilities. So, you know, there's a lot of exposures in the community, and we were doing a lot of education of our team members, not just for what their actions needed to be in the workplace to protect them, but also what they needed to do outside of the workplace. But still, a lot of people, you know, this was new. And kind of thought it might go away. And I think, you know, we see a lot of behaviors. So, you know, you see things that happen when, around holidays where we do see these spikes across the country, not just in our facilities, but, you know, in the communities in general. After holidays, people get together and they don't socially distance as much as they should, or they don't adhere to face covering practices, maybe don't wash their hands as much as they should. Anyway, you have these exposures that occur, and then we do see that reflected in the number of increases in cases associated with our team members. And of course, you know, inside of our facilities, we were following right along with all the CDC guidance and stepping above and beyond that. We had third parties that we brought in to help us make sure that we were minimizing the potential for any transmission to occur in our facilities. But, you know, it's an educational process. You have to get these team members to realize that, you know, we are working in a number of situations in areas where we can't always be greater than 6 feet apart in some of our production facilities. So we did a lot around staggering shifts and spreading team members out as much as possible. And of course, installing the barriers and individuals wearing face coverings and even face shields in many locations. Of course, hand washing, more sanitizer everywhere, and all the screening that we did of employees before they came in. But in the end, we see a lot of reflection of what's going on in the communities, and that's still happening today. I think we have our arms around it even more today, the numbers. But when we see increases or outbreaks in communities, we start to see that reflected in the number of team members that are positive in our facilities. So it's been quite a journey as we watch this. And yes, as you mentioned, over 100, we actually have 140 production facilities in the U.S. And we have about 120,000 team members in the U.S. And so that's a tall task to make sure that these team members are protected. Their health and safety is our number one priority. And, you know, that's always the message we're delivering during COVID. But of course, I always add on, it's our number one priority right along with food safety and quality. Right. But, you know, obviously it's a real priority. And I'll add one more thing, Barbara, and you may have a question about this, but from a food safety and quality perspective, I love nothing more than making sure that we don't have ill employees working. You know, it's one more reminder that that's an important thing. And it's also one more thing that we're doing very well of emphasizing hand washing more than we had on a normal basis, which we do a lot, of course, on a normal basis. But, you know, I love nothing more than when we do that emphasis and the cleaning and sanitation, cleaning and sanitizing in our facilities. So from a food safety perspective, that's one of the pluses of this is that increased focus on all the good hygiene practices that need to occur all the time right. In a food facility.
Right. So, you know, early in the pandemic, PPE was not widely available. And, you know, I'm wondering how fast you knew what you needed to do to keep your employees safe. How fast were you able to turn that around and actually make those changes to the facilities?
Well, I'll tell you, so a couple of things. First, I'll address the PPE and then I'll talk about some of the changes in facilities. But with PPE, you know, we were tracking ahead of CDC. You know, we knew that there was going to be a need to have facial coverings. And we were also very respectful of the fact that we didn't want to talk about surgical masks and pulling any supply away from that. But we do have a good procurement team. I've been so pleased at Tyson as I joined last year, some of the best procurement professionals I've ever worked with. And I've worked with some really good ones, but my goodness, we were leaving no stones unturned globally to achieve supplies of personal protective equipment. I'm specifically referring to face coverings, non-surgical, surgical style masks is really what we're calling them. And I mean, we have examples of chartered planes out of China where there were planes chartered just to bring face coverings to the U.S. for Tyson. And we had one exciting event where a plane was chartered, a lot of money spent to do that, of course. Supplies were arranged, And then the truck delivering the face coverings didn't show up to meet the plane to the chartered plane for us to come back. And it turned out to be kind of an international police investigation, but they did find the truck driver who apparently had known what the content, the cargo was. And there was apparently some idea that he or she, and I don't know which it was, but that they might've thought they had a pretty valuable cargo load and might've been able to make some money off of that. But the authorities were able to track down the truck, got it to the plane. We were able to get the plane chartered again and got those supplies, a number of pallets of face coverings just for Tyson coming from China. So quite an exciting time that it was, and a lot of stories we've got around this. But you know, we're really proud of the fact we were able to do this and get the supplies to help protect our team members. So that's kind of on the personal protective equipment side, at least just with face coverings. And similarly, we were doing things like that, were face shields, also things like gloves and things that and hair nets and face coverings, beard nets and things like that, that were kind of all a part of your overall wear, that the supplies were limited and we really did a good job of getting that. But then, additionally, the barriers and things like that, that we put up in our facilities, you know, that was a real challenge because, you know, we had locked down our facilities as far as visitors. And contractors that do a lot of that kind of installation are visitors. So we had a lot of vetting to do of those contractors. And there were some extra steps, of course, so that we didn't bring somebody that was potentially infected with COVID-19 into our facility as a contractor. So we went through a lot of vetting with that process, but we were able to make it happen as fast as possible. In a matter of weeks, we were able to install a lot of barriers so that we could protect our team members. But man, I tell you, it was an interesting time. Then rearranging traffic patterns so that team members, and you know, we'll have some of our locations will have over 4,000 team members, some of our large fresh meats facilities in the Midwest. And when you think of a shift change or a lot of team members showing up at once, you have that real potential for a lot of gathering. So we had to think about the flows and how would that happen. And they're gathering, we're kind of slowing them down as they're entering by taking their temperatures and evaluating signs and symptoms. And so we did, Tyson was in the news. We were one of the first groups to do major procurements of the infrared scanning systems, where they're walkthrough, pass-through kinds of systems for taking temperatures. Of course, we started off with normal kind of thermometers, the temporal thermometers that scan the forehead. And of course, that wasn't ideal, but that was all we could get in large volumes right away. And then we went to the handheld distanced infrared thermometers. And then very quickly, we got the walkthrough infrared thermometers. So that helped with the flow of team members through things. And then the staggering of shifts and things like that really helped as well. But those barriers, that was a tall task, but we got those in place. And of course, I would be remiss as the food safety guy here to not talk about the fact that, all right, my team thinks a lot about, and really our Tyson team in general, thinks a lot about, all right, what is this going to do to the potential food safety parameters inside the facility? So we've got these barriers. These are new surfaces now that are potentially going to be contaminated. How do we keep those clean? So we did a lot of HACCP plan reassessments and it increased our monitoring of the surfaces for pre-op swabs and things like that. And we were able to manage that fairly successfully.
You know, it's funny that you bring that up. I was going to ask about that because I've talked to some others who have used barrier systems in plants and they were just overwhelmed their sanitation crews with all the extra surfaces to clean. So I was going to ask you how your sanitation crew you know, picked up the slack for that.
Well, yeah. And, you know, I'll say we do have some really good sanitation crews. And at Tyson, we have a mix of internal crews where our Tyson team members will be doing the sanitation practices. But we also use some of the large third-party groups that'll come in and contract sanitation. And we have very good relationships with them and had a number of phone calls with them, conference calls, to really make sure that we were covering all the things that we needed to do from a sanitation perspective. And how do we interact with them? Because if the sanitation crew goes down, contract crew goes down, you know, that potentially could impact our operations as well. So it's not just our team members, but anybody that's coming into the facility. That's really a critical part of us being able to produce. So we had some good discussions with our contract providers as well to make sure that that was appropriately addressed. And if we had any positive contractors, how would that be handled so the appropriate notifications could occur? And there's also a very important part of this too. Barbara, I'll just go ahead and jump into this since I kind of led this direction, but you know, with USDA in many of our facilities, and we have some FDA regulated facilities, by the way, but with USDA in a lot of our facilities there all the time, we had a very important responsibility for keeping USDA informed about the status of our team members and if there were infections or exposures that might have exposed the USDA inspectors in the facility. So many, many discussions with USDA, their district offices and headquarters, about making sure that the right lines of communication were open and that that we just really had a buttoned up process with our government inspecting crews.
Sure, because there were reports of numerous USDA inspectors infected. So you didn't want those folks coming in your plant and putting your employees at risk.
That's right. So we have to protect them and then they have to protect us too with a good line of communication. You're absolutely correct, Barbara.
Right. So I want to talk to you about the balance between your roles in food safety and with this new role, essentially focusing on employee safety. It seemed to me early in the pandemic, if you have employees who feel that the company isn't doing all they can to protect their own health, that those levels of distraction on the part of the employee aren't going to be doing food safety any favors, right? You need those folks in the plants, you know, paying attention and focused on their food safety tasks at hand. So how were you able to really balance these two roles first and then also reinsure the workforce and the plants that, you know, as a company, Tyson was doing all it could to protect them and they didn't need to worry about that, could focus on their jobs?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And it was a tall, tall task. So, you know, I have the good fortune at Tyson of having some excellent, and I mean really, really good occupational health and safety partners. In fact, the Senior Vice President for Occupational Health and Safety is a peer of mine. We both report to the same person. And he and I have become quite connected and remain so today. And I'm in a supportive role. He has the lead on occupational health and safety. And then I support with a lot of technical and medical interactions, CDC kinds of interactions and things like that. But what a partnership. And along with our human resources team and our operations leaders, you know, there was a lot of collaboration that had to occur and daily meetings very early in the morning, by the way, because all the things would start a little bit later. So we had to have a lot of preparation going on in development of policies, development of communication. So it was a cross-functional group with occupational health and safety, my team in food safety and quality, the HR team, communications, legal, many, many people involved. But we had a strategy about how do we go and inform our team members. And as I mentioned, Tyson has a number of divisions, segments we call them, fresh meats, prepared foods, poultry, and things like that. And there's some different approaches and different chains of communication inside those organizations and how they do things. So we had to work with each of those to try to come up with the best way to educate the team members and align really on how we do that. And, you know, there are barriers in communication from a language perspective. We have team members that speak many, many different languages. We're something like 54 plus languages spoken across our company. And so that's one more barrier. So we a lot of translation of information that had to occur. And then locally, the plant management staff, leaders in the plant had to really make sure that that information was shared in a way that could be understood by our team members. A lot of signage put up, a lot of guidelines on the floor, you know, for social distancing and things like that, that all that came together. And I won't pretend that it was perfect everywhere, but a lot of effort went into making sure that that was as smooth as possible in a really tough time. And as you pointed out, we got a lot of questions from team members. So we have an employee hotline, of course, where questions could come in. If they didn't feel like they were getting support at the plant level, they could escalate that through our call-in line, our hotline for information. And I happen to have the consumer relations group on my team. And certainly I had the opportunity to review what was coming in from our consumers. And occasionally some of our employees would even call into that hotline. So we had a lot of routes of communication to make sure that we were hearing and kept our finger on the pulse of what was going on at our plants. And I'll tell you that early on, because we had locked down our facilities and everybody was trying to sort through how do we really manage this pandemic and protect our team members. So what we tried to do was close down our plants to any visitors, and that included corporate visitors initially. And that was a bit of a barrier to start off with, because you need to get out to see that. You don't want to be too out and potentially exposing the plant members to anybody coming in, or the people coming in to if there's any positive team members out in the field. So it was a real delicate balance. But I think after the first several weeks, 3 to 4 weeks or so of kind of locking down, we started to open up the doors a little bit more so that we could actually visit the plants and have eyes on and hear directly from our team members. We had presidents of our divisions and our CEO going out to visit with our team members so that we could really get that feedback and adjust as needed to their feedback.
Well, I think the meat industry, just by the nature of people working shoulder to shoulder, it presented some unique challenges that I think, you know, people don't understand and don't appreciate are going on. You know, Scott, you mentioned CDC a couple times. How frustrating was it to try and navigate the shifting guidance that was coming down from the agencies?
Yeah, it is frustrating, but you know, I kind of understand it because I you know, personally, so I'm going to give you Scott Brooks's perspective and then I'll give you, you know, some of my colleagues' perspective that don't always deal with science and CDC, if you will. So Scott Brooks's perspective is that I do understand that science is a moving target, and you know, we develop new information, new studies come out, and that guides us in changing things. And it's interesting, many of my peers at Tyson would read the latest and greatest study that has just come out. And I also, as a scientist, understand that one study doesn't necessarily make, you know, the way forward, that right. is not definitive, that over time science had. So I get that CDC responded and did the best with the information that they had at the time. And, you know, I've complimented my colleagues at CDC. I think they've, you know, that I was a public health officer in the military. Right. Prior life too, Barbara. So, you know, sometimes you, as a public health official, don't always get credit for all the good things you're doing. So I've often, in discussions with CDC colleagues, expressed my appreciation, because I know they're dealing with some really tough situations and they are putting in incredibly long hours. So while they're on the surface, they may hear some frustration with the changing guidance. I certainly understand it. Now, the broader perspective of non-scientists, if you will, or people that are just wanting to operationally execute, protect team members, and get product produced so we can keep the, you know, the public fed, there's frustration with that. So, for example, the guidance on wearing face coverings initially was to not wear face coverings, that, you know, certainly we needed to have plenty of face coverings available for our healthcare workers in the country, and certainly understand that. But it was a bit, you know, there's no need to wear face coverings. And then all of a sudden it kind of changed. And that was frustrating for a number of people that were kind of living with the guidance and don't wear them, and then all of a sudden wear them. And that was just one example of a number of things, obviously, over time that have changed. But, you know, we've worked through it. And I think my job has been, as a scientist in a high-level position at Tyson, to help with that education of my peers and other leaders in the company so that they understand what we're trying to do and try to interpret some of the things and changes as to why CDC might change their guidance.
Sure. Now, you mentioned, you know, one of the positive outcomes have been the increased focus on, you know, hygiene and sanitation. With the changes that you have made in the processes, what do you think is going to be a permanent change, or do you hope remains more permanent?
Well, I think there's quite a few things, Barbara, that are going to be a permanent change. We really are living in a new time in many ways. But again, the food safety guy in me says the focus on hand washing and really even greater attention to not working while ill or trying to tough it out and just show up and work. I think those are going to be changes that'll have lasting effects. I'm personally hoping they're forever effects, but I know that I've got an opportunity to take this information and use it as a reminder to people that, hey, this is the kind of reason that we don't work while we're ill, not just from a regulatory perspective or the right thing to do. This is to protect your health and to protect your colleagues' health in the workplace. So I think the emphasis on those two areas around hand washing and around not working while ill are going to be huge. And then, you know, we already have a pretty strong focus on sanitation, but this gives me one more reason to say why we have to be really good with cleaning and sanitizing in a facility. One more beyond the standard food safety kinds of things. And then I think it's also going to help us as we think about designing our facilities going forward. Modifications and designs with increased spacing, which will add some cost, but I think that's something we'll see. And also it'll help us think about our ventilation systems even in more depth than we have in the past. In the past, a lot of those have been, you know, for basic comfort levels, and then also for a ready to eat environment, for example. What are the needs there? But now we're adding some other factors to think about for things that might become aerosolized in a facility, for example. And I think that's going to be a permanent change as well.
Now, the challenges early in the pandemic, we've talked about, and they're pretty obvious throughout the entire food industry. But are there any ongoing challenges that you're facing, particularly as we gear up for like seasonal flu season or maybe a second wave of COVID?
Well, there are. And so I really haven't gone into the testing, although that's been a huge initiative for us at Tyson that we're actually quite proud of what we've been doing. But, you know, testing still has its limitations. The best tests, the genetic test, the reverse transcriptase PCR tests, still have to go largely to an outside laboratory, which requires often an overnight shipment. So you've got a delay of a day or so for that. And then you've got, you know, another day for results at least. So you're talking 2 days at least to get results, most commonly. And oftentimes, because of volumes, it's 3 days. And a few times it'll go over to 4 days. We have some good laboratory networks where we really monitor that turnaround time closely, but boy, it would be great to have results instantly or close to instantly. So we've had a lot of discussion around these rapid methods that are available, the antigen tests, for example, that are available. And the challenges there are around the accuracy of the test, the sensitivity and the specificity of those tests. And so we have not yet implemented the rapid antigen methods because the accuracy is so important to us in this topic. But we're watching it closely and talking to our medical advisors closely about how could we best implement some of those rapid methods. And so we're talking about things like pretest probability. So if someone is more likely to have been infected, let's say they're close contact, let's say, a test might be more accurate. If you get a positive result, you're more likely to believe it. Because somebody has a higher likelihood of being infected to start with. And that all ties in, of course, into sensitivity and specificity and predictive values of positive and negative results. But we're really working through that. So that's a real challenge, though, is thinking through testing of team members and having results as soon as possible so we can do the right thing. And so what's the difference? Well, you don't have to test. You could just put them out for 14 days, right, is one option. But that has a huge operational impact when you do that. And the team members, you know, they really do want to work. I mean, people will bring up examples of somebody trying to get away without working, but the team members really do, by and large, want to work. And so keeping somebody out for 14 days is not only an operational challenge, but it's not making them happy either. Even with the benefits that go along right now in the COVID situation, you know, so that we encourage people not to work while they're ill, it's still people would rather work. So those are some of the biggest challenges right now, thinking through those areas. And then if I add one more challenge to that, and it's related to as we move into the fall season, the opportunity for other similar illnesses to have an impact, like influenza and other respiratory viruses that might confuse the situation because we don't have let's say, a protocol for influenza about the number of days that somebody has to be removed from the workplace and quarantine. We basically have until, you know, they're no longer ill as a guideline, but it's going to generate some potential confusion. Now, on the plus side, and we were just talking to our medical advisors about this yesterday, we feel like because of all the travel restrictions, really, they're still in place kind of globally, and all the preventive measures with face coverings and hand washing and distancing, that we actually might have a little better flu season or a less severe flu season. That might help us a little bit. I'm crossing my fingers that that's the case, but that will be some of the challenges that we'll deal with, is some of these other things that are similar to COVID that might cause team members to very conservatively be removed from the workplace in the interest of public health. But it might have a significant operational impact.
Yeah, I think you're right about the upcoming influenza season. Countries like Australia and New Zealand, who went through their seasonal flu already, did report lower numbers based on the restrictions for COVID. So we'll keep our fingers crossed that this fall and winter we see the same thing.
Yes.
Has putting all of these plans in place related to COVID caused you to think more critically about your emergency management procedures in general?
Yes, I think it has. So there's a couple of things here that I think I can answer that question with, a couple of points. But first off, it's caused us to increase the staffing in our occupational health and safety team. So, you know, that's a little bit of a corollary to your question, perhaps, but it's, you know, the occupational health and safety team are really at the front line. So we're adding, by the way, Tyson is adding close to 200 occupational health specialists, mostly nurses and some administrative types at our plants across the country to really help beef up the care of our team members. Some of them are initially going to be dedicated to COVID care, but certainly over time, this will be broadly in their care. And it's kind of a part of a We Care program at Tyson. And we're doing a number of things that we're piloting with, and we've released some of this information publicly about a pilot we're doing at a number of our facilities where we're bringing healthcare to our team members, more advanced kind of healthcare support services. So I think that is going to help broadly in other situations. You know, inevitably there will be other pandemics or other pandemic scares, things like SARS original and MERS and Ebola and other kinds of outbreaks of perhaps influenza. And that's, of course, particularly of interest to us because many of the influenzas will be potentially an animal source, whether it's swine or poultry, right, or something like that. Right. But I think having better medical care and access to medical care at our plants will be something that helps us with our overall planning in the future. But no doubt it has helped us think about our structuring and how we are staffed to and organized to manage through incidents like this. So one other thing that we are doing at Tyson, we've announced, is that we are in the process of hiring a chief medical officer. And so that's obviously something that's going to have an impact on occupational health and safety. But also if we have things like pandemic kind of situations, that's great. And then I'm also very interested in that because having a partner, you know, knock on wood, if there was a food safety incident that involved illnesses, having a chief medical officer as a close partner in that, I think is a important thing for our overall crisis response that we would be engaged in. Again, I'm not hoping that I need to take advantage of that, but to have that expertise, sure, is going to be huge.
Sure.
And I think it's also opened up some lines of communication, Barbara, with CDC and USDA and to some extent FDA, since we're largely regulated by USDA, but some lines of communication that I think are good, and we'll can keep those lines of communication open.
That's great. Now, it's no surprise to anyone for me to ask a question about supply chains. I guess I have a couple questions for you regarding this. First, did Tyson itself experience major disruptions, maybe sourcing of animals, or even on the distribution end? And second, do you think going through all of this over the past year will forever change how the food industry views their supply chains?
Well, I think it is going to have an impact. But let me first answer the question about, you know, impact on us. And so, yes, we had impacts. What was interesting, though, is as as some of our facilities were idled for short periods of time, or we were at reduced capacity to process, you know, as a veterinarian, and I have peers in Tyson, of course, a number of veterinary peers, we were very concerned about the impact on the animal population too, the welfare of animals. And that's a really tough thing where there is not capacity to process the animals, and they maybe grow to a, like in right. poultry, for example, grow to a size that can't be processed through the system. So that animal welfare impact is significant, and one that we're obviously paying a lot of attention to. But then certainly downstream, as you think about what you have processed, getting that through distribution to retailers is a challenge. And then also with food service operations shutting down, or at least significantly reducing their consumption of many of our products, just logistically making the transition from food service production to retail production, which was going up, and then getting it to facilities, the retail locations, was tough. And I know a lot of your listeners experienced some empty shelves or near empty shelves with meat and poultry products, and that was frustrating in many ways. I will tell you that I could see some of that coming, so I did add a few. I bought a few extra pounds of poultry and stocked up my freezer, and I probably didn't contribute to the availability as much as I should have, but I can't go without a good steak or some good poultry, to be honest with you, Barbara. Anyway, so I had my refrigerator taken care of, but it was frustrating, and we did have some challenges there. But I think after we really got organized and started doing the additional testing measures with our team members, but also fully implementing all the things, and the community started to get an understanding of the outbreaks that were going on, we were able to appropriately staff. We had problems with absenteeism, which impacted our ability to produce, of course, but we were able to staff and manage that to keep, you know, the animal proteins stocked on the store shelves. And I think today you can see that's working pretty well. But there was a period of a month or so there where it was a little bit barren in some shelves.
So, Scott, as we wrap up today, what do you see as the major unintended consequences of COVID on the food industry?
Well, there's many unintended consequences, but I think just trying to keep those supply chain lines going, because so many supply chains, and I think this goes beyond the food industry, Barbara, I think so many supply chains are focused on just-in-time kinds right. of processes. And that really highlights, the weaknesses of that are really highlighted in a situation where you have a disruption. And it's not just a disruption in one location, it's across the country or in many, many locations across the country or international. When you have that kind of thing, that, you know, just-in-time kind of approach is a real challenge. And I'm not an expert in all the things in logistics that we're doing to manage that, but I know I have colleagues that are working through a lot of that, thinking about how do we manage this and proactively manage this, you know, for the future. And I think that'll make many of my peers in the world of supply chain really adapt some. So they weren't thinking that in January, right? when the year started and the goals were being set, but now we're adapting quite a bit to those things.
Anything you want to add before I thank you for joining me?
Well, you know, I might just add, you know, around the sanitation perspective, Barbara, there's, you know, a lot of good things that have come out, and you're seeing a lot of information come out about the best sanitizers, and there were a lot of questions about, you know, are they effective or not? You know, fortunately, the coronavirus is an envelope virus, relatively speaking, easy to destroy. And then I think, you know, the sanitation companies and the companies that are doing sanitation, trying to do everything they can to protect their workers. And you see this outside the food processing industry, you see it in hospitals, you see it in the airline industry, you see it in hospitality and in hotels and things like that. There are a number of solutions for sanitation that come out, and some of them that I'm kind of excited about are some of the long-term residual ones, the organosilane kind of products that are coming out. American Airlines recently announced they have a product, and that gives a lot of confidence to folks that the cleaning and sanitizing, which occurs in between flights, that there's some residual kind of things. And I think that's some interesting things, and we'll probably see a lot more products like that, and it'll change some of the world of sanitation. Some of the product offerings, I think, will be more modern. And I'm also understanding there's EPA is thinking differently about how they register some products related to long-term residual kinds of control. I just thought I'd share that with you because I think that's an interesting change as well, just in the industry, in perhaps changing the way that we think about some of the cleaning and sanitizing chemicals that are used.
Yeah, there certainly are a lot of innovations, not only on the sanitation front, but on the auditing front. We could devote another podcast to the auditing.
Well, thank you, Barbara. I should mention that. You're right. That's such an important one. And my team's very involved with this, but the third-party audit groups, the remote auditing technology, which is obviously one of the things you're alluding to there, is huge. And our team has been experimenting with Google Glass and a number of other things like that, even just FaceTime, right, with an iPhone and audio capabilities. Some of the challenges inside of a plant with a Wi-Fi connection. But that's been huge. And actually, I'm really glad you reminded me to bring that up because that's been huge. We think that not only will it help us with, you know, getting through a pandemic kind of situation where you have limited access to suppliers or even your own plants, but it's going to supplement us going forward in the future. So I think we'll have more engagement with our suppliers and our plants through this remote video kind of capability. And I really think that is a big thing that's coming for us. And we're going to take full advantage of that at Tyson.
Great. Well, Scott, again, it was such a pleasure to have you back on the podcast. And maybe sometime in the future, when COVID is a distant memory, we'll have you back on to talk about all the other roles that you play at Tyson.
Well, thank you, Barbara. I would look forward to that. You know, there's so many things going on that we haven't even touched on in the world of food safety, particularly in the meat and poultry industry, but certainly across the board. Would look forward to that opportunity, Barbara.
Sounds good. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Thanks again to Scott Brooks for joining us on the podcast today. And of course, thanks to all of you for listening. You can find links to all the references that we mentioned in our episode in our show notes. You can access those on your podcast player or on our website at foodsafetymagazine.com/podcast, then find episode 84. Please don't hesitate. Send us questions. Send us suggestions to podcast@foodsafetymagazine.com or post a note on Twitter, LinkedIn, or Facebook. You can make sure that new and bonus episodes magically appear in your feed by clicking that subscribe button. And it's always helpful if you take a moment and rate the podcast. It helps us and it helps other folks find us. And, well, it helps me when I have to pull up reports and give them to the, you know. We've been rated X number of times. So anyway, it's all good. Thank you for everybody who has rated us. Thank you for all of you who are going to rate us. And thank you in general. We love you guys. All right. That's it for us today. Our next regular episode will post on December 8th. Take good care of yourselves and those around you. And we'll talk to you then.